Welcome to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. We continue our South Start series with Dr. Michelle Perugini. Michelle is an academic, entrepreneur, and an internationally renowned expert in health, medical research, advanced analytics, and cognitive AI. Michelle spent the first 13 years of her career in health and medical research, specializing in predictive genetics and translational medicine. Michelle then co-founded global technology company ISD Analytics with her husband Don, who is also an accomplished scientist, selling the business to Ernst & Young in 2015. With little time to rest, the Perugini's founded Life Whisperer, a company that uses technology to help improve the chances of IVF couples having children. This is AI-driven, cloud-based image analysis that improves the accuracy of health embryo selection in IVF. In conjunction with Life Whisperer, the duo also launched another AI company, Presagen. It has been a remarkable journey for someone who didn't feel born for entrepreneurship. Michelle shares her story, the naivety of her approach to her first company, and learnings from that experience that she has taken into Life Whisperer and Presagen today. Michelle is also speaking at South Start in 2018, a conference that celebrates the collision of people, ideas, and technology, on from the 21st to 23rd of November in Adelaide. Make sure you join and support Adelaide startup community. Get more info and tickets at southstart.co. Now enjoy the interview with Dr. Michelle Perugini.
Michelle, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Pleased to be here. Thanks for having me.
I love asking, you know, high achievers how their day starts, especially with all these bits in your world going on at once. What does the first few hours of your world look like?
Oh, wow. First few hours of my day generally comprises coffee.
So what time does the alarm go off or the kids wake up?
Look, it's probably around 5:30, 6 in the morning. Coffee, lunches, getting the kids ready, you know, ferrying them off to school and then heading into the office.
That doesn't sound very glamorous.
No, it's not glamorous at all. Who told you it would be glamorous?
True.
What's the dynamic like when you work with your husband?
Correct.
You got him at home all the time. You can't escape. How do you balance that?
We find it works really well, actually. We've worked together for around 15 years now. We even studied at the same time doing this, you know, did our PhDs at the same time, kind of had our first business from, you know, early 2000s. We've got very complementary skill sets and I feel like we can really step in for each other. So if it's dropping the kids off or if it's, you know, getting started in the office, getting started with work or taking an early call, it's just really nice to have that backup.
Come back to, I guess, your own childhood. Was science always ever present in your life?
No, not at all. Not at all. So my parents come from very traditional kind of industries. My mum's a nurse. My dad was a toolmaker for his life and we had family businesses in the nursery, you know, plants and the wholesale nursery industry. And, yeah, I just really developed a passion for science probably around year 11, I think. So I was quite a late bloomer.
So it wasn't like mucking around with, what was the chemistry set? I remember one of my mates had one of those in primary school. You know, you'd mix up some colours and, you know, this wasn't grabbing you at an early stage.
Nope. Nope.
Wow. Not even burning things with a Bunsen burner.
Nope. No, okay. I really didn't know. I loved school and I loved everything. I loved the humanities subjects. I loved geography. I loved science. And I didn't really know what I was sort of going to go into or where I'd end up. But I think in around year 11, I started really getting into the kind of human physiology and loved understanding how the body works. So for me, science was all about understanding the human body and how that works. And that kind of, I think, you know, provoked my interest in the more detailed sciences.
Do you remember a moment, was it when you were selecting subjects or thinking about uni where the path became clear as to what you wanted to study and then go on and do?
Yeah, I think from year 11, I really wanted to do medicine. but I didn't get the grades to get into medicine, so I always selected the subjects that would allow me to do that. And then what ended up happening is I took my next kind of favourite course when I didn't get those extraordinarily high grades. And that was a genetics course. So I did medical and pharmaceutical biotech. And when I kind of got into that course in undergrad, I realised that it was just this crazy fit for me. I loved it. I loved the exploration of research and science and being guided by a problem and then being able to kind of come up with your own solution to that problem. And I realised that medicine was definitely not for me. So I'm actually really glad that that happened, just serendipitously. Mm.
As you're on this journey, is there an entrepreneurial layer bubbling away underneath? Is there interests in business? Any of that starting to come about?
This is going to be a very boring podcast. No, there wasn't. There wasn't.
Well, hang on.
No,
but this makes it more interesting. But your parents, you see, that you said they were in small business, so that by absorption you might have got a little bit of it.
I think I was absorbing some of it.
as long as you weren't smoking it, then that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, that's right. I've always been an entrepreneur deep in my soul, I think, but I don't think I recognised those qualities or even what an entrepreneur was at that time. So for me, it was really just the problem solving, the being able to take kind of my own, you know, guide my own path and journey, which I guess is what an entrepreneur is, but I was never thinking about it in the context of, you know, starting my own business or, you know, or running my own thing at that time.
I mean, it is a cliche too. We've interviewed a few people that entrepreneur that have had that entrepreneur journey, and it always, you know, the cliche is it started with selling Coke bottles in school or something like that. I mean, I never did that. I was never interested in that. But clearly,
not much of a market for Coke bottles, to be fair.
Well, true. But clearly there's an underlying passion with an obsessiveness about what you're doing, which are hallmarks of entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
When you're coming through uni and you're starting to obviously get some good grades, I mean, what was your thinking at that point in time about where you were going to go?
I think I was quite happy at that point in time to kind of pursue a research career, and I did that for nearly 10 years. So I was a stem cell biologist for 10 years. I, you know, had my own team, and I loved every minute of it. So part of me is kind of a complete extrovert where I love kind of communicating with people and being out and about and talking to customers. The other part of me just loves sitting in a back corner in a laboratory and running my own experiments and having my own kind of time. So I think I just really enjoyed that whole process of kind of building a research program and, you know, and doing that really detailed research on a very specific thing. But then after I had done that for a period of time and I felt like I'd achieved what I wanted to achieve there, it wasn't enough. And I felt like I had more to give. And I felt like that was just kind of one part of me that I'd kind of fulfilled. And at that time,
did that play out in just being frustrated or unsettled, or what did you notice about that time? You know that you knew you were ready to move.
I just felt like I had more to give. Like I just felt like I wasn't being completely utilized, if that makes sense. Mm. So I felt like I wasn't reaching my full potential. Don had been at Department of Defence for around 10 years as a research scientist. He'd done a PhD in AI. He was solving all these amazing military problems that we couldn't talk about at the dinner table because it was all classified.
Surely he gave you a little bit of intel and just said, keep on the download? You're kidding.
No.
So
just a little whisper, robot armies are coming.
Shh, drones.
So it was
we're such nuffies.
I think at the exact same time when I was feeling that kind of constrained, you know, that I was feeling quite constrained, I think he was feeling the same. And we had this conversation, you know, I said to him, you're not happy doing this. It's not enough. He's an extremely ambitious person. And we had the conversation about why don't we just take some of this technology that you've developed and apply it to some real world practical applications, because technology was amazing, but it was kind of kept in defence. And that's what we did. And that's when we started our first business.
So what were the early steps then from being unsettled and going, okay, well, let's start something. Mm-hmm. Well, what are the first things that you did?
The first things we did were really strategize about what the product would be and which market we would try and access first. That was really challenging for us, and it was actually to a little bit of our detriment, because the way we did that was in a very scientific and research-based way, not a very commercial way. So we went out to the university, talked to a professor there who happened to be in the water economics area, very well known, highly respected, and we said to him, hey, we can solve this problem for you that you've been, you know, trying to solve for a period of time. We can do it really quickly for you, demonstrate the capability, and then, you know, hopefully he'll be an advocate for us. Exactly what happened. So we solved this problem. It was awesome, really convinced him. He became our advocate, but then we kind of got channeled into the water industry, which was not a very profitable, quite a, you know, conservative industry to start with. So that was a real challenge. But having said that, it was kind of a good way in to do something. And, you know, we created quite an advanced water demand forecasting model as our first product.
And this is at the front edge. I mean, no one was really talking about AI back then. It's easy to talk about it now. What was the landscape like when you're talking to people about, you know, this new technology?
We basically had to hide the fact that it was AI. So we were not open about the fact that it was AI. We called it behavioral simulation.
So it was a limiting factor.
Ridiculous. Yeah. So there was a real fear factor around AI. It was, even despite that AI bit, just even advanced analytics was not really a thing. Everyone was kind of back in the, data mining and just those really traditional kind of statistical methods. And we were coming up with this way of kind of predicting and simulating whole populations of consumers and their response to new policies or products in the market. It was kind of, there was sort of a sense of voodoo around it. And, you know, what is this and how could that possibly work? And no, it's too good to be true. And, you know, we'd need to understand how it works before we'd have comfort in using it.
It is incredible how quickly those tipping points occur and public sentiment changes quickly. Just jump ahead for 2 seconds. When do you think that the tide turned and people just go, this is accepted and this is the new frontier?
I actually have a view that the tide hasn't turned.
Okay.
I think there's a lot more conversation around AI now, but when you actually get into the corporate environment and businesses actually using the technology, there's still a sense of kind of voodoo, black art, you know, black box type, you know, sentiment around it. So I think it's getting better, and the more conversation that happens, and the more corporates kind of jump on board for fear of missing out or, you know, not getting ahead of the game, it will become better over the next kind of 5 to 10 years, I think. Yeah.
What were some of the other early learnings about business that you went through in that time, good, bad, or ugly?
So many. It was challenging as, I guess, to researchers to, you know, start our own business with zero business experience, not much capital behind us. We kind of bumbled through those first few years, really, just flying by the seat of our pants, really, trying to get, you know, government contracts, which we did. I'm still surprised now how, you know, how well we did to land some of those big contracts as a very small team. I think one of the biggest challenges for us was mentorship. So there weren't a lot of mentors around at that time, certainly not in the area that we were playing. And it's really hard to do it alone without having those connections or networks into the market and without having that business experience.
Were you conscious of that at the time, or is that, oh, geez, you know, we could really do with some mentors and support? Were you actively looking for it, or is it more in reflection now, looking back, you go, actually, we could have?
Yeah, no, we were totally naive. We had no idea. You don't know what you don't know. Yeah. So we had no idea that that's what you should do. We did seek out mentors, and we had a couple of good ones. But it was, you know, we kind of thought you just persist and do it yourself. That's kind of the mentality and how you go about business.
A lot of the listeners love to hear, I guess, the mechanics of those, that first year or two. Did you both quit your jobs and have no salary and just back yourselves in? Did you have a bit of money that you'd saved that you then used, or did someone inject a little bit of sort of seed funding?
Yeah. We had no capital. we had nothing behind us, other than, you know, some small amounts of savings. We sold an investment property that we had to keep the team going, and I worked essentially two jobs for the first 6 years. Wow. Of the business.
Yeah.
So what we did is, I was still working in a research capacity whilst we had the business. We funded our staff through that money. We didn't pay ourselves. We, then, you know, had some consulting work come in that helped us fund the development of the product that we eventually sold.
And just describe, I guess, that those first few lean years. I mean, were there doubts? Were there moments where you thought, is this going to ever get anywhere? Or did you have sort of that blind faith?
I wouldn't say we had blind faith. There was a lot of doubts, but we really loved what we were doing. So we were willing to kind of forego the money to build something greater. That's kind of what we were always in it for. It was never going to be a quick kind of, money-making opportunity. It was something that we wanted to develop some really significant capability and, you know, something that was world-leading and global.
What was perhaps one of the main breakthrough moments for the company where things went to the next level or you got real clarity about the market? I don't know. What does anything come to mind in terms of getting you to that next level?
Couple of points. So we pivoted out of the water industry and into other more profitable competitive sectors, like still in the utility space, energy, did some work in health. We're in kind of bushfire modelling, some other areas as well. The real turning point, which is a bit frightening, to be honest, is the acquisition, which is kind of right at the end. So it's kind of, you know, it was a little bit of, you know, struggle, build, struggle, build, struggle, build. Wow, we've built this amazing capability. We're now in six different industries selling globally. And then, you know, all of a sudden we'd created enough value for an acquirer to come along and, you know, see that value and take it on.
Were you aggressive about pursuing an acquisition? What happened?
No, we were not pursuing an acquisition at all. We had set up an office in Silicon Valley. We were actively looking for investment. We were going to move over there because there was a lot more investment, funding there and a lot more tech talent in our space. And Don had spent a significant amount of time over there kind of scoping out the market. And right when that happened, we were pursued. I think it was after we had won one of the AIII awards or something like that. And we were pursued by someone from Ernst & Young and they said, don't do that. We'll buy you. And
was that an email or a conversation or a phone call?
No, it was a conversation. And I actually remember, not sure if I can say this on the podcast, but actually remember saying to John after, this guy was crazy. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, no one does that. And then, you know, did a bit of searching on him and seemed bona fide.
You didn't think it was legit to begin with?
I didn't think it was legit. No, because we hadn't really considered a large kind of international consulting firm as one of the obvious acquirers, if that makes sense. Mm. But it did actually make sense with their strategy and advisory function where they're trying to kind of put more evidence base behind their strategic advisory pieces for clients. So that's kind of where it fit into there.
So you mentioned the award. So that put you on the radar, you think?
I think it was just we sat next to this chap at one of the dinners.
This is so bizarre because people always like, no. I think everyone has ideas in their head about how an acquisition goes down and it's just like just a bit of a chat. At the table and done.
It's very different now. So with what we're doing now, because now I actually see the signs when we're talking to kind of large potential acquirers. I know the signs and I can gauge their interest, but I think we were just probably, you know, either didn't notice it was something that was so far left field, that it wasn't really on the radar of kind of other larger companies at that point.
And how long did that acquisition process take?
It took about 6 months. Yeah, about 6 months from go to away.
And were you connected to the future of the business for a period after the acquisition or you could step away?
We did step away. So we were there for around a year and a half. So we kind of managed the integration of the product and the team, our whole team went across. We managed the integration of the product into their global suite of analytics products. And then we kind of got the itch to move on and do our own thing again.
So from that point to when you step away, how long was the journey?
A year and a half.
No, I mean from the moment you started the business.
Oh, right.
So what are we looking at?
So about 9.5 years.
Yeah. Yep. Wow.
Yeah.
We're always, whenever we talk to someone who's had an exit, we're always interested in the state of mind, the thinking about life after the exit. What were you guys thinking at that point? Okay, deal's done. You could maybe relax for a bit, or was there that immediate urge to move on to the next thing?
We were pretty tired after that year and a half was up, to be honest. And we thought, let's just take 6 months to kind of reconnect and take stock and see what we want to do next, because we didn't really have a plan. We knew we definitely, you know, had in our psyche some, you know, products that we were looking to develop and thinking about. But we tried that and it didn't work. So we were out for about, I think it was a couple of weeks, and then we were extremely bored. And we're like, well, this isn't going to work. So we kind of reacquainted with the startup community, got involved in every accelerator, commercialization program, universities, just helping mentor others, pro bono, just to try and re-engage with that space. And yeah, we really enjoyed doing that for a period of time.
Before we move on to Life Whisperer and that phase, can you debunk or clarify this, what is AI? Like, you know, people talk about an algorithm and go, well, that's AI. Other people talk about, you know, kind of predicting the future. And like, how do you best describe what AI is?
It's a really tricky question, because the way, I mean, a lot of what people talk about when they refer to AI is about deep learning and machine learning, which is essentially, you know, statistics on steroids. It's just kind of a really smart way of applying statistics with a great amount of computing power and large amounts of data. So that's kind of a pretty standardized technique. But there's other areas of AI which relate to our first business, like behavioral AI, which is very different. That's about understanding human reasoning and decision making and then building a computational model to kind of mimic how people make decisions, and then using data to build the context around those decisions. So that's a lot more advanced and just a very different kind of style of AI. But I think people always tend to lump AI as just this one thing, but it's actually a whole collective of different technologies, techniques and approaches.
That behavioural stuff just must be fascinating, because, you know, there are so many that it's not behavioural. You know, responses are not often considered in certain things. Like, I think about the stock exchange and, you know, what happened, the GFC, and, you know, how these things aren't predicted or taken into account. Like, it just staggers me, because it's pure emotion. Like, the stock exchange is driven on emotion as much as it is anything else.
The challenge with the behavioral stuff is actually how people make decisions is quite predictable. What's changes is the influences and the context that's bearing on those decisions at the time. So when we used to do, you know, behavioural modelling projects, for example, you know, looking how to get teachers to move out to regional and rural areas. Well, if you do a survey, everyone says, pay me more money, right? But it's actually not the money that drives that decision. So you put in an incentive to pay them more money and they don't go. Why is that? It's because they've got children here, they own a house here, the schooling's not good there, there's no family support. It's all that contextual environment that drives that decision. So even beyond what we think ourselves is potentially driving that decision.
So you're telling me I'm fairly predictable in the way that I'm going to respond.
Yes, absolutely.
Based on my history of decisions, I'm pretty much going to follow the same path.
Yes, correct.
Just in different contexts. Mate,
I didn't need a PhD to tell you that.
You're a James Whisperer.
Yeah, exactly. So to come back to the story, tell us how the next idea came about and how you decided, right, this is the one that we're going to pursue, we're going to, you know, start this process again.
Yeah. So it's kind of two things that were happening in parallel. So Don and I had this idea to create another platform capability, not around the behavioural modelling, but more around automation. How do we kind of automate either the development of AI products or workflows, you know, to create efficiencies in business? So that's the Preston platform that we've developed now, which we can talk about a bit after.
And that came first?
It came almost at the same time as the Life Whisperer product. So Life Whisperer, I was mentoring in the Adelaide University eChallenge commercialization program, and my mentee was Dr. Jonathan Hall, who is a very talented physics PhD graduate.
Sorry to jump in. I just love how your mentee, so someone that you're mentoring, is just another PhD person.
He's actually got two PhDs, which is entirely ridiculous. Jonathan, if you're listening, we still don't understand why. but he did his first PhD in theoretical physics and then wanted to kind of diverge into the biological space. So he did a second laureate or PhD in nanotechnology. And he was kind of working with a group in the fertility space, and they were looking at all sorts of ways of kind of imaging embryos. But they involved kind of putting stuff in the culture media or, you know, shining a special light or a laser on the embryos. And his thinking was there must be a non-invasive way that we can do this using the computational technologies that are available. And I loved it. I was drawn to it immediately. I think it was on our second meeting I said to Jonathan, I think we should just do this. Like, we've literally got the collective skill set to do this. We've got a bit of funding that we can seed it with. He was very driven and passionate about kind of taking it out, and commercializing it. And that was kind of how that started.
Wow. This is something that I talk about amongst my friends all the time. So I'm wondering if you could shed some light, but my perception is that couple struggling to conceive, that it is really prevalent. I mean, I can count on 37, 38, and I can count, I think, 7 or 8 groups of close friends that have really battled.
Yeah.
Do the statistics show that it's increasing, or is it just that the access to IVF is becoming more doable?
No, it's definitely increasing. It's increasing at about 12% per year globally, and that's only on the reported amount. So the way someone's reported as infertile is basically if they've gone and sought out medical advice because they haven't been able to get pregnant for a period of time. So it's likely to be a lot higher than that. But it is increasing because people are choosing to have children later in life. So there's more women working and, you know, having other commitments. But also, increasing obesity and other kind of physiological factors.
It just seems not that it's spoken about at that broad level. Like, I just don't read too much about it at that broad level. But when you talk to people anecdotally there, and they'll all start to go, yeah, I've got 5 or 6 friends and then you start to join the dots and you go, wow, there are a lot of people out there really bad. And it's heartbreaking.
Increases. Significant.
It is significant. And pretty much, like you said, I mean, I had trouble conceiving my first child. Took us a very long time, and I couldn't understand why, because I was very healthy and fit and there's nothing, you know, medically wrong with me. But it was a very difficult process. And I know, you know, since kind of working in this industry, people are very open and honest about kind of their struggles. And it's literally everyone I talk to pretty much either knows someone or has gone through that struggle themselves. So it's definitely a big problem.
You know what I love too is that the genesis of your husband's world, which is about defense and army and potentially killing people, and now the application of this stuff is you know, giving, you know.
I influenced him away from it.
Yeah, come full circle now. It's a beautiful thing.
I guess there's the other layer as well, which is IVF has its challenges as well. What are some of the key challenges and problems with IVF, particularly the ones that you guys were looking to solve?
Yeah, I think IVF in general, I think there's a couple of aspects. So from the patient perspective, it's quite an emotional, financially, you know, difficult kind of process to go through. It's very expensive. There's high expectations on a successful pregnancy, and the success rates are still very low. I think from a scientific perspective, although a lot's been done scientifically over the last 40 years, it's very difficult to experiment on embryos, right? Mm. So there's not been great models of experimentation. So I think one of the key factors during the IVF process is you have eggs fertilized with sperm. They develop into embryos in a culture dish over a period of 5 days. And that point where they're picking which of those embryos to put back to the patient, that's a critical point, the selection of which of those embryos is going to result in a baby. And all we're doing is using, deep learning and computer vision to better select which of those embryos is likely to create a baby. And so it's quite a nice way of not impacting the process that they're currently using, but providing more evidence base and rigor around that selection process to hopefully improve outcomes.
So what are the factors in that selection process?
Currently?
Yeah.
Yeah. So currently the clinician or the embryologist will look down a microscope and they'll make a visual assessment of the embryo. Challenge that they have is that a good embryo and a not so good embryo essentially look the same to the human eye. So very difficult to discern. So they've got a pretty, high level selection criteria that they use, but it's not very effective and there's not much that they can base that decision on. Whereas the deep learning and computer vision is about sort of taking thousands of historical cases where we know what the outcome was and then getting the computer to create an algorithm, a selection algorithm from that, understand what a good embryo looks like, or, from those that created a pregnancy, what are the common features of those embryos? And then you create a model that's predictive.
Feels to me that one of the most interesting parts, I guess, of that sort of process is that it continues to get smarter. I mean, the more information pumped into it, the smarter it gets.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've already evolved our study. So we're working with a big US set of clinics at the moment that we're partnered with. And so the first iteration of the product is, viability assessment, so picking the best embryo based on how it looks with the algorithm. But what we've also done is conducted an initial feasibility study looking at whether we can actually detect genetically defect embryos, and we can. We were able, with our computer vision and deep learning approach, we were able with a high level of accuracy to detect Down syndrome embryos.
Wow.
And that's because those genetic defects are so profound in the embryo that it results in a physical change to the embryo that we can pick up using our technique. So it's quite amazing what you can do with these sorts of, approaches now.
Sorry, Monty. In sort of a broad overview, I mean, I'm really interested as to the phases of a medical startup. I mean, we might get some funding, you build a website, and then you're trying to solve a problem. What are the broad phases that you go through to build a successful medical business?
Yeah, this has been something that's been quite a learning experience for us, because even though I've come from the medical space, it's very difficult. It's very different to creating a medical device that you bring to market. So basically the phases are, proof of principle. Does the thing that can you actually create an algorithm that can predict embryo viability? You do some initial testing with a customer. We use all de-identified data to do that. And then the second phase is doing the more extensive clinical studies. So looking in different laboratories in different geographical locations, doing validation studies on their data sets to the extent where you can, justify that the technology works and is effective and is better than what they're currently doing. And then there's the whole regulatory phase, so going through regulatory approvals in the different countries. They're all different. And then eventually you can get the product to market.
So hard, because it's not like you can just, they always say in startup world, get your product in the hands of customers, ASAP, get feedback.
This is what investors keep telling me.
Yeah. But it's not like that
no,
at all.
No, it's not like that.
That's a massive challenge.
Yeah, it's a big challenge. So basically you cannot get to revenue until you've done all the clinical studies, all the clinical testing, gone through regulatory approvals, and then you can take the product to market.
So how do you have conversations about the commercial side of this? When you don't necessarily have a customer validation, and you've got to try and talk about markets and pricing and things like that.
With investors, you mean, or?
With investors, yeah.
So we've been pretty strategic with our approach. So our validation studies serve as kind of a pre-sales mechanism, if you like. So we prove it within your clinical environment, then you've got a level of comfort around the technology and how it works. You do some usability testing of the actual product. And we've always been upfront and honest about the pricing model and things like that. And then you work out, you know, just like in any other business, how, you know, what the demand is in different country areas and how you think you can access those markets based on that price.
It's fair to say, though, it's more resource intensive and capital intensive in those first moments than a typical, you know, sort of website based business, I'd imagine.
The challenge is you've got to really back yourself. Yeah. So we've self-funded up until this stage because it's very difficult to get funding for an AI-based medical device.
Really? I thought it would have been all the rage.
Yeah, it is all the rage and everyone loves it, but no one wants to back it because it's very high risk. So, I mean, I guess it's got a different risk profile to many other businesses. So the risk profile is kind of twofold. It's technical risk. Will it even work? And even to get to the extent where you've tested it enough to know that it does work is a significant amount of capital. And then the secondary risk is the regulatory risk. Will you get it approved and can you get it out to market?
And then as co-founders, as you're building out your team, what are the components of your team that you have to go and recruit people for? Like what are the main chunks of your team?
Yeah, so our team at the moment, we've got a very small team. So we've got a Don and myself who do a lot of the commercial kind of strategy and running the business. I take the CEO function. Jonathan's the technical lead. So he's the CTO equivalent, although we don't really like those terms because it's crazy because we're four people in a business.
Yeah. Sorry, talk to the CEO.
I just, you know, hang up the phone and then go pick it up on the other side. And then we've got, Jonathan's very experienced in kind of the machine learning, AI and computer vision. And then we've got Andrew Murphy, who's a software engineer. He was actually part of our previous business and helped build, led the development of our platform that we sold. So
from your first experience to now with this company, what are the things that you're doing differently?
I think our mindset's very different, very, very different. So we're really enjoying it this time around. I think we kind of know when to not worry when things take too long or a little bit longer than expected. We kind of know the stages that we can expect. So we've just got greater clarity around what, you know, what's going to happen and what's normal and what's good and what's bad. Mm. So I think mindset's a massive thing that's changed for us this time. And we're far quicker. You know, it's been under 2 years and we've taken this, Life Whisperer product through, you know, multiple clinical trials. We've got around 15 clinics globally, on board working with us, providing data, running validation studies where, you know, we're hopefully about to close out an investment round, looking to get to market middle of next year. That is extremely quick for a medical device, particularly something very technically advanced in the AI space. So I think, you know, that never would have happened if it were the first iteration. Mm. Yeah.
As we're moving into the South Star conference coming up soon, and you know, you've talked about global capability. Have you been tempted to be in the thick of research in Sydney or Melbourne or Boston? I mean, how easy has it been to drive from Adelaide?
Driving from Adelaide, I have to be honest, it is a challenge because we don't have everything here that we need to necessarily run a global business. For example, I think the capital situation still needs improvement, and I'm probably a little bit biased because there is capital, but certainly not for our type of industry. So that's made it a little bit challenging. We always view ourselves as global, not as an Adelaide-based company. So although we're positioned here and we want to add to the ecosystem and drive the ecosystem and we will certainly keep a team here, we do need to make sure that we've got people in those markets that we're operating in, because if our business as a whole is not successful, then Adelaide will not get the kudos for having developed an amazing company. So I think it's just, you know, it's a great environment. It's a great collaborative environment. It's definitely improved over the past decade massively. But I think there's still the need to kind of be everywhere if you're developing a global business.
Who are the key people that have been with you on this journey? I mean, obviously your husband and you've got your core team, but who are some of the other people, those mentors, those influencers that have helped take you to the next level or inspire or be that support?
Oh, wow. That's really tough. I don't want to single out any individuals because I think that would be meaning that I miss out a whole bunch of other individuals. I think it's the whole ecosystem, to be honest. I think we've had a huge amount of support from kind of government in terms of the Tech and SA funding, the early stage funding. We've had a huge amount of support from the general ecosystem, like the incubators, like, you know, ThinkLab and CSIRO. We've had general kind of great rapport with the media here who have helped us enormously. And then just the general community of entrepreneurs, I think, has just really grown in the state. And it's more that collective influence that's really helped.
It's interesting because it seems like you guys are, and you've mentioned it, that very open. And it's like you recognize the need for mentors in those early years. So is that almost like a bit of a strategic approach to be open, to be collaborative, to look for opportunities to bring others in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you have to be open. There's no point in kind of hiding in a back room, doing what you're doing and not talking to anyone about it. It's ridiculous. And a lot of people do this in their first business because they're scared that someone will copy or someone, but the reality is if you're not out there and showing people, no one knows you exist anyway. So what's the point? And I think you're better off staking your claim, saying this is what I'm doing, and then run hell for leather and just make sure you do it the best and keep iterating and just keep improving so that you can stay ahead of the pack.
We just laugh because we've had a few conversations with people where, you know, you sign an NDA to talk about an idea, you know, to have a coffee. And you know, I probably thought that too when you very first, you know, have an idea, but what you soon learn is it's just such a small part.
You do know I thought about the iPhone first.
Yeah.
Doesn't actually mean I developed it.
I might struggle to replicate Life Whisperer.
Ideas are a dime a dozen.
I could just picture us with like a photo and just some circles around a dodgy looking embryo. Probably my last question before we get into our rapid fire, which is just a series of short questions that may or may not have anything to do with what we just talked about, which is a bit of fun. What is the market size? Like, how do you quantify what the market size might be for you? I mean, like, I want a big figure that you go to invest, say it's worth $58 billion.
Yeah. The market figures in this space are really sketchy because the reporting's really sketchy. There's around 140 million people globally that are infertile. So that's the overall market.
Well, let's just give that 140 million times by, like, what does an average, you know, cycle of IVF cost?
Well, it can be, you know, average probably about 10 grand.
Okay. Yeah. Well, there you go.
So, I mean, it's billions. It's tens of billions
there we
of
go.
Dollars.
See?
Yeah. It's a massive industry.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not asking you to reveal too much of your strategy, but what are the key goals coming up for you guys? I mean, obviously the capital is one thing, but over the next 2 to 3 years?
Yeah. So capital critical for us because we need to expand our team. So we need to expand our sales and technical team, and we need to get through the regulatory approval process. So we're in the process of refining our algorithm and locking that down now with the current clinics that we're working with. Start of next year, regulatory approval process through the FDA, TGA, and to get CE mark approval in Europe and UK. And then we'll hopefully be out to market middle of next year in the US. And then it's kind of Australia, US are our first target markets. Australia's quite a small market for IVF. US is a huge market for IVF. So that's kind of our target international market, and then subsequent expansion into Europe, UK and China.
Didn't we invent IVF?
Yeah, we're world leaders.
Are we still well thought
of? We are extremely well regarded in the IVF space, particularly from a research and development perspective. It's just that, just purely based on our population size, it's a very small market. So certainly we will want to be getting out to market in Australia, but the US is kind of where it's a very large market that can help sustain the business.
Right. Rapid fire. The only criteria is that you're not allowed to sit on the fence and have an answer which sort of like, you know, splits down the middle. So,
here we go.
favorite scientist.
Oh, favorite scientist.
Just come up with a big one.
The whole point of this, we get to ask the silly questions that you might get asked potentially if you go and talk to some kids.
Oh my God. Next, I'll come back to that.
Okay, pass.
The most frustrating thing about working with your husband?
No alone time.
Mm. The least scientific kind of thing in your life that you are the passion or hobby that you have?
My kids.
Oh, no, they don't count.
Oh, wow.
Of course they count.
We make the rules up as we go along with this.
Netball.
The most inspirational or influential book that you've read?
That's a tough one too. Wow. I'm drawing blanks. Or just a book
you might remember that's been interesting.
Yeah, actually, there's one by, I think it's Dale Carnegie, called How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. That would be one of them.
On your weekend, one of your favourite routines?
Hiking up Mount Lofty.
What's on your Spotify playlist right now?
Hot Hits Australia.
Do you listen to podcasts?
I just lost a bit of credibility.
No, that's good. Do you listen to podcasts?
I do on occasion, but I don't really have a favourite.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah. So.
No. That doesn't count as a question.
Yeah, I said, do you listen to podcasts? She said no.
No.
Well, I'm out.
A friend that is still important that was there in the early days.
A friend that's still important that was there in the early days. Oh, wow. I have a group of friends that I've been friends with for 20 years.
Just give me some names.
Oh, my God. Oh, can I give you a whole bunch of names?
Yeah.
This is really unfair because I'm going to miss people
Bruce Radio is not about, you know, getting everyone in the...
Yeah.
It's not about fairness.
It's not about fairness.
Yeah.
It's just about what you remember when you put on the spot.
Yeah. Tanya and Johnny, our mates Luca and Diana, definitely huge support. We've all got our own businesses, completely different spaces, but, yeah, definitely.
School friends
support.
Or business friends or...
A mix, yeah.
If you didn't get excited by science in year 11, what path would you have gone down?
I probably would have done year 13 and tried to get into medicine again.
The last question for me from Rapid Fire is the area of science that interests you the most at present that isn't IVF?
That isn't IVF. I think just human biology in general and cancer genetics.
Michelle, thank you. What an incredible hour, I guess, that we've had. And we didn't even get on to the family dynamics of how you juggle, you know, bringing up kids and managing these businesses. But you've just had such a rich, you know, work life to this point. It's been incredible to sit down and pick your brains with that. And also, you better watch out. Otherwise, you'll have that label of becoming a serial entrepreneur soon if you keep going the way you are. So
it's better than a serial killer.
Well, maybe there's some AI.
Or a serial pest.
Maybe there's
a serial pest.
If you can go into predicting who the next serial killer will be, that will be interesting. Thank you for coming on to Rooster Radio. It's been awesome.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed our chat with Dr. Michelle Perugini. Make sure you check out Michelle and many other awesome speakers at Southstart. Open your browser right now and visit southstart.co and get involved. Connect with Rooster Radio and listen to more than 100 interviews with interesting people doing amazing things at roosterradio.biz. And if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast player. Thanks for listening.